Our forum this evening is on the subject of who should make what decisions at times in terminal illness. I guess I would like to say that we're not trying, in my understanding of it, to try and deal with issues that maybe we are have faced in the past. I guess that's the thing. I want to be sensitive to the fact that some may have been through some things where, as you reflect on them, they still raise for you some kinds of strong feelings. If you can share with us, if there are things that you have experienced, I think that would be very helpful. I am not talking out of firsthand experience in many cases, and it's only my purpose to get it started, and then let's see where you want to go with it. My thought was that it would be appropriate to include in the village, because in the other 2 weeks that I was here, in both cases there were people who were medical personnel, doctors and nurses both, who said they would like to talk about this issue. Now, I'm not saying we all have to be doctors and nurses. In fact, one of the things that I think that they said very clearly was that they felt, as doctors and nurses involved in the health care and the care of people at a terminal point, that they knew that they had to make decisions. But what I was hearing from them pretty clearly, I believe, was that they did not want to make those decisions by themselves. One young doctor who worked in the area of rehabilitative medicine said that one of the first things that he saw his task came to have a need to be expressed was to involve the family. Now, in his case, it was not always terminal, but where there was a whole adjustment in a person's life because of some accident or illness, he felt that it was necessary to build a support system and build it fairly large. So he drew in the family, the friends, and tried to talk through the issues that they were facing and what some of the things that needed to be there. One of the reasons I guess we need some sense about this, I was trying to think of some of the things that have excited it for me, and let me throw those out and then we'll go to general discussion. I guess one of the first times it really impacted on me heavily was an article, a letter to the editor, that was written by a gentleman in Washington, D.C. His wife and he had talked over for some length of time that if one of them would become ill and would reach the place where their bodily systems would only maintain themselves by means of machines, that they would like to request the doctors to withdraw care. It's called passive euthanasia, meaning that they're not going to try and keep the body from following the status of where it is. They had both signed a statement when they were in good health. Both had registered it with a lawyer. Both had shared this with their physicians. The letter that appeared in the paper appeared because the husband was very upset because as his wife did reach that point that they had decided the care should be withdrawn, the staff at the hospital where she was refused to honor that. Their reasons were that they did not want to place themselves in a position of facing lawsuits for non-care of a person in dire need. So they said, we have no recourse but to continue treatment. The husband went with the letters and his lawyer to the courts and said that they had, in sane mind, prior to that, made this decision, and he asked that the court would rule that this was a legitimate request and could be honored without any threat to the doctors. At that particular point, the court did finally make a decision, and I think, as I recall, and this is where I'm fuzzy, but it runs in my head that what they did was made a decision that it could, that the doctors could be safeguarded, the treatment could be withdrawn. That was after the wife, as in the husband's judgment, after she had suffered about 6 months of pain and agony that he felt was unnecessary. This raises a lot of issues as to whether or not these documents are legal. My wife and I, Esther, have signed what we called a living will, which simply was that same kind of thing, saying that we did not want extraordinary treatment. We do not want for ourselves extraordinary treatment if we reach that kind of stage where it looks like we are ready to go. Part of where I guess some of the issues lie is that when you're looking at a person who has lived a number of years, it's easier to make a decision on the assumption that if we have now reached the terminus of life, for us to live is not the thing that is totally the thing that has to be. Our faith says, whether I live or whether I die, I am Christ. And so that carry through as to whether or not I am now alive and physically able to operate is not of the greatest essence. I can also say, I thank you, Lord, now let your servant depart in peace, according to your word, for my eyes have seen your salvation. And so faith would allow us to say that at this point, now no longer do we have to extend these kinds of things. Now, there are other things, I guess, as I'm thinking about it, maybe that's enough just simply to set the scene. I don't know where you want to go with it. I don't know where maybe there are concerns or things that you have experienced. Our time in the forum here is both to raise questions that you have no answers about. It's okay to wonder. Maybe we can be of some help with each other, or maybe you've got some things that you would like to share. So it will be my role to simply to see if we can get around and get anybody to share who so wishes. So, yes, upstairs.
Yes. By making this living will, do you feel that you have in fact made a, and I hate to use the term, it would be very hard, a suicide pact, thereby violating an ethical and moral question of the church and the Christian faith that you're taking your own life by saying ahead of time, I'm going to give it up, and that I'm not trying to maintain my life?
Well, see, I guess what you're saying is that sounds a little bit like it might be a suicide pact. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
If that's true, then it is.
Then it raises the question of your faith and the idea that you're taking your life, which is a violation.
Well, I guess I'm not sure that suicide is one bag. I'll shake that one loose. I'm simply saying that, as far as I'm concerned, if it is a matter of saying, yes, I choose at this point to die, we all do that. For instance, there is a drive that keeps pushing us, and maybe only for a day or two, or it might be a week. But when a person makes a turn, it can be possible that they are shortening their life. For instance, my wife's sister died of pneumonia when she was maybe, her sister was 13 and my wife was maybe 11. And I remember her telling me how when her sister was so ill, her mother kept saying to Jean, please do not die and leave us. Please do not die and leave us. And that was her theme. And finally one day, mother saw the whole agony that was going on for Jean. And finally she said to Jean something of the fact that, Jean, we know you're very ill and that you're going to leave us and we are going to miss you very much. Esther said Jean was able to relax and die within 24 hours. But now, there was a case where it was a psychological sustaining, mm-hmm. which was... let's see, I think it was here.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't call it suicide either. The fact is, I would find it much more comforting and at ease for instance, the children to have to make that decision or not to have to make that decision if, for instance, I as a father had stated those wishes beforehand rather than putting it on the responsibility of someone else. I think it's a beautiful thing to do if that is the wishes of the person. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes?
Yeah. My perspective is colored by the fact that I'm a family physician. I've just finished 3 years of residency training, and I think two or three comments come to mind that I'd like to share with you. One, I think in response to your comments about the intensive care unit and the discussion of what should be appropriate medical care, I think is premised on what you were saying last week, John, about communicating to the family as much as possible what your desires are. Now, John was talking last week in terms of death and the management of death. And I think that, you know, as much as possible, individuals that I take care of who have terminal illnesses or who have severely debilitating illnesses, who have clarified to me their wishes, I in turn will ask them to clarify those to their family. There is real question in the courts about whether or not those written documents are legal. And I've had that come up with one particular person, and the only way I could sort of morally, I wanted to accept it and say, fine, if I'm the one taking care of you at this time, I will respect that, but I can't guarantee her that, so that as much as possible to communicate that to her family. My feeling has been that the climate for communication in my experience has been very open. That I have talked to a number of families about what they felt was appropriate, what their desires were. I think there's a certain category of illness in patient that's important for us all to be aware of, and probably are. In the medical community, the younger the person, the more sudden the illness, the more aggressive will be most medical actions, because you know, time and time again, when I've been involved with discussions, we've looked at sort of what the health, what the social, the familial sort of whole picture for that person was before the illness, and we try to weigh very carefully what we know about the particular illness, the odds, the statistics, the complications, the consequences of that. One of the terribly frustrating things for me is that with a young person, the power of the body to fight illness is remarkable. And children are a marvelous example. Many of the children who've been in severe car accidents and coma for long periods of time can have complete miraculous recoveries, it seems. And one of the early things we learn is that ability to support as we wait and watch and see what happens. Now, the older you get, the less ability the body has to do that sort of recovery sometimes. And that's the place where it becomes wrenching to try to decide, because you weigh what you know about statistics, and yet you say, indeed, there's a possibility of hope and something unique with this individual. On the other hand, because medical science is advancing and there are possibilities of doing things, those that want to be very aggressive will say, hey, something's going to come up for us. And I think there's where you need that careful, deliberate consideration, prayer about what is appropriate and what is not appropriate. So I think those are just a couple points. The one, that the fact that the age of a person and their prior health definitely is a very major factor in how aggressive my colleagues in my course of my training have been. And secondly, that perhaps where we've got to keep reflecting is as we see our medical sophistication advance, that ability to say, hey, we still don't have the judgment and the moral and ethical sophistication perhaps that's commensurate with what we have the ability to do on the shield.
Mm-hmm.
Age is a big factor, is what you're saying. Yes, yes.
John, I just want to say, two questions come to my mind. When we pray daily, we say, let thy will be done. It seems to me if it's human's will, when we continue to lengthen this life, when we know, you know, when everybody seems to have given up, it's, I think God is the one. If you take the machines away, you're not committing suicide by just letting the person die in dignity. I think to me, if it's God's will, that person will sustain anyway. That's just the way I see it. I don't see where it's a suicide at all. I just think it's human's will having to give up God's will.
Okay. Yes.
Toss a different bone in the mill. Would you feel irritated if some outside force interfered with your will in this matter, such as the courts in this?
Let's throw it to the group.
In the sense of saying, do the courts interfere? Should the church interfere in my decision? I use as example the Catholic religion, adamantly against this type of effort. And coming in and your priest advising you to, or your pastor, if it's his decision, whatever your faith, right? Should they advise the family and the doctor to continue treatment where there is pain and suffering?
Okay.
Should the outside influences be there?
I think that's just an excellent question, because that came up in the state of either Wisconsin or Michigan in the last 2 or 3 months when an infant with Down syndrome was born. And the family, there are a number of congenital anomalies that go along with some Down's children. This particular child had a short esophagus or swallowing tube, and so would be unable to get any kind of nourishment without surgical intervention. The family and the physicians decided not to do that, and that was brought to the attention of the courts, who then raised the issue of, do they have the right to do that? And it was a long, heated, and painful battle. The family was allowed to go to that decision.
Yeah, but in the meantime, what happened to the child?
The child died.
Yeah. I mean, but the dragging out in the courts, right, forces them to abide by their rule.
The role of the court, I think, is to safeguard whether or not a person is maybe being, whether their rights are being abridged. I think that's the function of the court. One that I remember, the fact that you said you worked in intensive care reminds me of a story that was told to me by a friend of our daughter's who worked in intensive care. This was a woman who was somewhere around the age of 80. She was admitted to a hospital near us where, on an examination, it was found that she had a form of cancer that was fairly well advanced. The doctor got with the daughter who lived, I guess the mother lived with the daughter. And so the doctor had a consultation with the daughter, and they felt that it was appropriate to operate. And so the daughter signed the paper. I think that's the way it went. But what happened was that when the mother heard about the fact that she was to have surgery, that dear little old lady got up pretty well on her horses and said, "Wait a minute." She said, "I am in possession of my faculties. And it seems to me that decision I ought to make, not my daughter." And she said, the way this nurse reported it was that the mother got very adamant and asked the daughter to leave, the doctor to leave. She sent for a nurse to go out and get the release papers so that she could sign out against the advice of her physician. She called her son-in-law and asked him to bring a little bit bigger suitcase and some extra clothes. And she said, "I'm going to tell you where I'm going to go, but I don't want you to tell my my daughter until I have a chance to cool down." She said, "I'm going to go to a motel somewhere nearby here, and when I have cooled down enough to talk civilly, I'll call you, and then you can come and get me." So she signed herself out. Now, the point that I thought was that that doesn't often happen, but this is an instance as to who should make, see, in this case, it wasn't the courts.
Oh, yeah.
You know, this woman felt violated because she wasn't considered And it was her daughter and the physician who, certainly love and care, as they thought about it, were making a decision for her. So here's another case where the decision was made against us. I don't think that means that we have to play God, but I just wanted to say it isn't necessarily just the courts.
Right.
That the issue that you have raised is that it's really a consultation in which, and I think that issue is, there's no way to get rid of this struggle. No way to get rid of the pain. No way to be sure that you can make an easy decision. And I don't think there's anything that you can finally say that solves it, so you can lay a chart against it and make a decision down there. You sweat everyone out, is my guess from what I hear in your saying. Uh-huh. Yes?
I went through a situation with my mother, who had cancer and 20-some years of suffering with it. The last 12 years of her life, I can remember her praying to die. You know, let me die. Which was not God's will at the time. She was totally prepared to die. In her faith, she knew where she was at and what would happen when she died. It wasn't God's will at that time. When it did come time, the doctors, there was nothing they could do. You know, they told my father, you know, she very slowly slipped into a coma. And they said, there's nothing we can do. We can keep her alive. But they knew that was it. She had made that decision through her faith in Christ that there would be no problem with death. And when the doctor said she would die, you know, she continued to live until the next days, because as my father said afterwards, you know, it's just like your mother. She never would give in to what the doctor said. They had told her, you're going to be in a wheelchair. She never spent a day in her life in the wheelchair. But 12 years prior to her death, she made no papers. It was prior to this kind of thing coming about. But she was so calm within herself, and her faith was strong enough that it didn't make any difference. Live or die, she knew that she would be happier dead than alive, and she would not feel pain. And, you know, her physical state the night before she died was absolutely grotesque. After that was one of the few times I ever saw my mother at peace. I mean, total peace. And it was very, very comforting to me and to our entire family when she did die. There was nothing that the courts had nothing to do about it. The doctors had nothing to do about it. My mother was at a point where her faith was strong enough that the faith took care of it. I don't know where that goes. It's just what happened.
It's a good sharing. Thank you. Yes?
These questions about children, I think, are especially very difficult. And we come in a little late, maybe discuss this, like with Jehovah's Witnesses and some others, where they will not permit blood transfusions and so on. There are some limits, I think, to where the parents have authority over children, too, and their welfare. And there are many precedents, I think, where courts have stepped in and responsibly saved children's lives. The situation about the child that, in effect, starves to death when there are people very eager to adopt the child, that really is that's a tough thing to stand by and watch that happen. If there is some promise of some fulfillment of life for the child.
Yes.
So another point is that in Seattle, a couple of years ago, a woman refused treatment to her son who had appendicitis, died. You know, that's really hard, even when you read it and you're not even involved, to understand that type of thing and to, you know, accept that woman's decision for her son. When you know a simple operation at 10 years old, that child would have been fine. And I don't know. How we approach something like that.
The age does make a difference, and that agony of another family is against our decision. Yes?
No, I think we switched over in talking about a different segment of the population than we started out. I think the issue of who should make the decision is a crucial one. I think when a child is born that's severely handicapped or appears to be severely handicapped, or even not so handicapped, but that maybe at that time the parents aren't the best ones to make the decision. They are, at least in isolation, they're suffering a lot of trauma and shock, and no one is ever prepared for the birth of a handicapped child. So that issue of who should do it. I heard a doctor speak on the issue of children born with spina bifida. Maybe some of you know and don't know, that's where the spine is open and can be varying degrees of handicap. And he said they used to stand around and decide whether they should perform the operation to close the opening of the spine. That used to be a question. He said, I'm really glad that no longer do I have to deal with that. That's not an issue. We close the spine. We do what is the life-saving measure. That's not our decision to make. That doesn't always mean the child lives. It means the child lives most of the time. I happen to work with handicapped children, and one of my favorite stories is about a little girl who was born with spina bifida, and it appeared that she would be very handicapped. And the doctors advised the parents of her condition. The parents were very distraught and felt that they really couldn't deal with having a child with this severe of a handicap. And so they said, no, don't close the spine. Don't do that extra measure. And so everybody waited, thinking the child would surely die. But the child didn't die. And so after waiting, and I don't know how long this was, they did the operation that was needed. And there were complications. Turned out that the child needed a tracheotomy and took the child home and had to bring the child back. Anyway, to make a long story short, the child pulled through. And at 18 months was brought to our early intervention program, could not speak, had never made any sounds at all. But we started working with the child. About 6 months or so after we started working with the child, one day I was working with this child with a therapy ball and talking to her as though she understood, and there was a sparkle in her eyes and all of this. And I said, come on, Christine, hold your head up. And she made a sound, and I said, somebody else in the room, it certainly sounded to me like she said I did it. And so I again encouraged her, you know, come on, hold your head up. And she said, I did it. That was the first words we had heard her speak. She's now 7 years old. She whips around school in a wheelchair with the brightest smile in the school. Her eyes sparkle. She can read above her age level, when it's normally found above her age level. She has learned to walk with the aid of crutches. But beyond that, there is a spirit and a joy in this child that cheers me up when I'm down. So we don't always know how things are going to turn out. And I think especially when you're dealing with children, playing God is a real dangerous thing.
But the people's period, human being period, is dangerous.
Can you say that a little bit louder? I'm having trouble here.
I was just saying, I think playing with life like that, you know, is really pretty dangerous. Human beings, period, regardless of the age, you never know.
But I guess just to say again that who should make that decision is very difficult for parents, for doctors to lay that out and say to parents, well, what do you want me to do?
My understanding is that they don't. I saw here and then some, who here?
I was just wondering, I know of a case where the doctor has made the decision without the parents of not using any measures for that child. The mother happened to be a nurse and pulled her child out of that hospital. She flew her around 200 miles in air ambulance. She was the only attendant outside of the pilot. She said, I almost lost her three times. And she came into the hospital at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. The doctors did not stop working on that child until about midnight when they had her stabilized. That child today is 6 years old. If she is a damaged child, all children should be so damaged. because she reads about 3 or 4 age levels about of where she is in school.
Jerry,
she's beautiful.
And up there.
Oh, I get just a couple of thoughts that came to my mind. I suppose this might, well, first one would be how do we relate to our bodies? That is, am I my body, or do I have a body? Another thought that has come to my mind is we're using the term death and the term life as if we understood what they were, and I don't think we do at all. And I think as so-called the technology of medical science has moved into a realm where it makes very ambiguous what the world is like and death. It is, you can keep some hulk of a biological mass doing something that could be defined as life for a long time with flat brain waves, but you maybe keep the heart pumping. Is that life? Is that alive? We don't. The line between life and death is more ambiguous than we would have to be. And even the question of, I can make a premeditated decision to sacrifice my life without it being suicide. And I think somehow, without thinking out the details, I think I would be willing to throw myself into the breach and sacrifice my life for my wife and my children or something like that. I wouldn't be committing suicide. So, but the issue of what is life and what is death, I think that's a real fuzzy one. And I think that as the technology improves or deproves or whatever you want to call it, it's going to get a whole lot more hairy. I mean, I can foresee in the next century or two unbelievable things happening in the technology of science of cell anatomy and all that junk, man. I mean, the box has just been opened. Kind of, it's going to get real complicated. So I think as Christians we need to think in terms of that. I mean, Jesus made a decision to walk down to Jerusalem. Peter said that's suicide. But giving up his life for something was gave it. It's a little fuzzy.
I know your hand was up. I want to see if I can find this. There was a physician who last week made the reference about two things. One was the amount of our medical costs. See if I can get that. 50%, he said, of the medical costs in the U.S. is spent on people in the last 2 weeks of death or of life. 50% of our medical costs is used to extend the life of people 2 weeks. And so, you know, that's another issue that goes in there when you raise that, you know, what do we think about life and death? You know, where's that line? That tremendous cost, the economics of it are there, and that's another issue we need to talk about. Yes, sir?
My idea was halfway stolen. I was thinking that the technology of medicine is advancing at such a rate, it highly influences that statement you made earlier about, yeah, up to extraordinary means. Mouth-to-mouth resuscitation used to be considered extraordinary means for maintaining life. Nowadays, it's very common to go in and be put on a heart-lung machine to maintain life while you're in surgery. What's extraordinary? Tomorrow, it's just the next day it's that. Are we looking for guidelines to help us in that fluid of a situation? Is that a question that we can toss in? Or are we looking for a pat answer that'll work always?
Certainly not the latter. My understanding, and John Crump, I think that's his last name is correct, a medical student who was on staff here until last week and has gone on a hike now, reported that on a case in Minneapolis about a policeman who was hit. Some of you were in on that session. And as I recall, he described 4 levels of treatment which were defined by the hospital. as to different levels of extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And that had to do with machines. Second level, if I remember correctly, had to do with medication to fight infection. Third level had to do with tubes, and the, I guess you used the word ventilator, although it's more than that. And the last was the very simple thing, so just simply water, liquids. And so that I hear that that's already defined. But
so
again, I beg pardon?
So what's the limit?
Well, it seems to me that the limit that I heard John talk about and that the other doctors were talking about is they have these stages, and that's where you've got to struggle it out. That there, that, you know, you have to, in the light of the age of the person, the other factors, et cetera, you have to literally pray it out. Yes?
I was wondering if you had heard about hospital in California. I just heard about this right before I came here. There's a big convention. My head nurse came back and she said that a hospital in California was practicing kind of a, it's like a category list. If you're between the ages of 20 and 30, you're given a number of 5, and it goes up. And if you've ever had problems, I don't know, just different categories within your history. And then as you're added up, as these numbers add up, they will do less and less and less.
No.
And I just couldn't believe that, but she said that's what they would do. They were trying to pull
I've
through.
Never heard of or any
and so, I don't know, even if it's not true, it still brings in the point of where are we going to go. There's the question of, you know, we thought that a lot of these future shock things were just absurd, you know. But it raises the question of where are we going?
I think just one other sidelight to that, both for reassurance and also perhaps some alarm. You know, we talked about sort of the technology of change that's happening. Deep down, I'm still very committed to the notion of primary care, and that's the area that I'm in, so that colors what I say. But, you know, my feeling is that as much as possible, as we are able to establish relationships, not only with family, but with physician and primary care over extended periods of time, to become aware of our sort of medical condition, our familial involvement in that, and those decisions are easier to make, I found. I trained in a large city county hospital, and I have a large number of my own family practice patients who I would care for, but I would also take care of many people I had never met before who came into the emergency room, a near drowning victim or whatever, and I had no idea about that situation. And I think all these situations have to be individualized and very carefully, deliberately thought through. But one concern I would have, I think a lot of my fear begins to grow when I think about the machine of medicine, those hospitals. What if we have a car accident, you know, when we're out in the middle of nowhere and we don't know anybody and they don't, you know, we're both injured and who's going to make the decisions for us? You know, those are logical fears, and they're things that, you know, we do need to play out. We need to think through those things, and I think we need to find guidelines. I don't think we will be able to establish absolutes. And,
yes, here and up there.
No, I was just going to agree with what I said over here. My uncle just passed away in May, and you know, he had no family. But I live in a small town, one hospital that is struggling to stay alive, but a one family physician, and he knows the whole family, and the family knows him, and the issue of even trying to support, you know, or extend the life of my uncle for a week or two was never even brought up. We just understood it was his will to die. The doctor understood it, and you know, his nephews understood it, and it was just easily to handle it. In a big city where nobody knows nobody, nothing, I can see it be an entirely different situation.
Yes, up there and then down here.
Okay. Taking a point from Roger, you fell into it. This idea of a big city by a small city, in the big city you can become lost and lose the communication ability. I've heard of support groups and hospices that provide professional help in this area. and they're generally in large cities, and as the pure experimental, in the sense that if you wish to try and say, I want to refuse extreme aid, you can go to these hospitals, and they will provide family support, personal support, medical support, and in these areas. And there is an effort, I think, in the big cities to provide an answer. May not be always be successful, but it is one means of saying, and you, if you ask, generally the hospitals will tell you if they're available.
Or even suggest it.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think you can't belittle the importance of the economic factor in this. It bothers me the statement you made that 50% of the expenses in hospitals is on the last 2 weeks of life. I've been reading a lot lately about the plight of the third world, and personally, if I were about to die or in a coma, I would rather that my family terminated my life and spent those thousands of dollars to improve the life and health of really poor people, people who need to learn how to boil their water, to have basic immunizations and lots of things like that. And is it moral to spend thousands of dollars on one person when that money could be funneled to improve the life of thousands of other people?
Mm. That's an important question, Jack.
I have a question up here, John.
Thank you.
I have a question. A case which actually happened. My niece was taken to the hospital for all practical purposes. She was dead. And yet her family was presented with a $5,000 bill for 2 hours in which they did a pacemaker transplant with no authorization. How can this happen and how can we combat it?
I don't know the case, and so there's...
She had no life signs when she arrived at the hospital, and yet they were presented with the $5,000 bill for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how to respond to that, because we don't know the case.
It's distressing to the family.
Yes,
yeah,
I'm certain of that.
I deeply empathize with that situation. I guess only trying to explain, not justify. I know I have been in situations where, you know, a call came through that a paramedic van was bringing in a person, no details were known, you know, it's been 5 minutes since they'd arrived and the person was not breathing and they were doing cardiopulmonary resuscitation. They would be arriving in the emergency room in 5 minutes. And at that point, you know, not knowing anything about previous history, family, the condition of this person whatsoever, you know, sort of all systems go, particularly, again, weighing this with a young person as opposed to an older person, there are certain set number of things that you do just like tying your shoe, one right after the other. In the meantime, with the help of other people in the emergency rooms who in those large situations, usually there is a social worker, there is a patient pastor, trying to contact people, find out, you know, family, what have been circumstances. The horrifying thing to that is the cost. Many times in those situations, if one looked at the statistics on the outcome, very, very few people are saved. And yet, I think that the onus has been upon our shoulders to, at the sake of possibility of saving that person's life in that situation, you do what is within your armamentarium of care.
But don't you believe putting a pacemaker in was an extraordinary procedure?
Well, there's a technique that is not, it's hard to define that, but there's a situation when with medication, starting an IV and the medication does not work, you would actually just, you know, put a needle directly through the chest to try to pace the heart. So that it's technically, it is an extraordinary measure, although it's not an invasive, well, it's sort of invasive, but I mean, in terms of some types of things, it's able to be done within minutes, and it has saved a number of lives.
The thing is, too, if you don't do it, then that's that whole other side of it. You know, the family comes and says, but you didn't do anything, well, you know, to save her, and you say, but we couldn't find the people to get permission. You've got the whole, I mean, I hear what you're saying. You do what you can under the circumstances, and
Yeah, sure. That's what you do.
Isn't there, I mean, this is directed to the doctor. Isn't there some effort amongst the medical profession, and I've heard quite a bit about it, trying to specialize in the medical emergency area and trying to get a separate definition from normal hospital care in the sense that the medical emergency, right, is taken into the realm of extraordinary treatment, specifically making that the ordinary treatment for the definitive reason that they don't know all of the details, so we take the extreme range of options to try and save this person's life, which is their goal and their life objective and their business. So, in a sense, the emergency room treatment is a different world. It's not your normal everyday life of where we have time. We have 5-10 minutes, and I'm talking that short of time, to sit down and talk about what decisions can be made on this person's life expectancy. Our objective is to take the major objective, they will be saved if we apply all of the knowledge we have today. I mean, if they have to go into surgery for 8 hours and they die on the table, unfortunately, how can you make that decision before you go in that they will? So the medical, I mean, that emergency room techniques are moving to a different definition, which scares some people, but then again, it provides a feeling of trust in the medical profession, in my mind, that if something happens, I know I'm going to get the best treatment when it's needed. And it's a specialization now that most people don't understand. And it came about through, unfortunately, treatment of war patients and their medical study of how to respond to trauma, as they say. I mean, you've heard the words on all the TV shows, but it's true.
We're at about the time that we need to pull things together. I think we've covered the major issues. There's one that was suggested that I guess I would like to reemphasize the issue on medical costs. I don't think that we can solve that one through. But that has to be there because of the issue that this young lady brought up in terms of the total cost. The other side of it is that that's available to some people and not to all people. It's just simply that way, that if a person is poor, everything comes at a different level. But I'm wondering if we could summarize by saying, wait a minute, I wanted to throw in one more thing, and I'm not sure I want to open up a whole subject there, but the issue that was raised earlier is the will of God. And one of the things that I see people within the church struggling with, and within the Christian faith, and with religious concerns, is if you, and this has been enlarged now so that it's not just the clergy that face this, many churches have people who are committed and have some awareness and are willing to go and do visit with people. If you're visiting with somebody, and let's say this is an older person who is extremely ill with a little hope being extended, either in their mind or by the medical profession, if they tell you they would like to die, and would you pray with them that God might take their life? We haven't talked about that one. Again, I guess that's something we have to think about. I would, myself, I think I would have to take that very seriously. It's really the words that kind of close the book of Revelation. Come, Lord Jesus, come quickly. That it's not a way in which we can deny or cut that out. But I've had a great many people who have said, yes, they would. Yes, they would. There would be an act of faith to be able to stand there with that person and let them manage what they're asking, literally that God would help them do what needs to be done at that point. To walk with them on that journey. It's kind of the sitting and just being there, available to hold a person's hand as they go through that process. I don't know how you react to that one, but I'd like to take just a minute with that before we can conclude. Is there a rebuttal or yes?
Well, it's just like with a cancer patient. There's different stages that they go through as they dive into the acceptance. And maybe at the end, if we can just hold their hand and listen to their acceptance, you know, into another life, you know, I think that's a good thing if you feel within yourself that you can do that. It's just a way of letting them express. You're not being ashamed. You know, you're okay to say how you feel. And if that, you know, to be with them, to know that God is with them too, has been in life and will be in death. And that's my feeling on it.
Yes.
You said something the other night that I think would fit in here. If I prompt your memory, I think you can say it again. It was in the discussion of the tax withholding issue of the pastoral support for a unpopular or disagreeable point. And a person being able to give pastoral support for that effort, would this apply? Would that statement apply to this situation too, in the sense that you disagree with them morally, ethically, or however, but pastorally, you're providing them the support, which is what the church has obligated itself to do.
I'd have no trouble with that. Amy?
I look at it at that point of praying with them and saying yes, and that one at that time could pray the prayer of relinquishment, that thy will be done, and then whatever happens, happens. But I think that's a point of being able just to give up our own will to God.
I would like to thank you for participating this evening. I do not assume that we are finished. And I hope that this is not a subject that will be left with you here. I hope that if discussions like this do not take place in your home community, that maybe you can help them come into place. I'm particularly saying this because there are Christians who are involved as these people in the medical profession, and those of us who are struggling with them to understand and be faithful both in life and in death. And that one of the things that I think is helpful is if we can open these discussions, keep them open within the household of faith where we can care for each other, that maybe this will be for the life and the goodness of us all. So thank you for this evening.